This Much We Know is a podcast offering an honest and informative perspective of the realities and motivations of setting up a social enterprise. We will be joined by a number of charity leaders and social entrepreneurs whose trading models work to end homelessness. We will be sharing their stories, tips, and of course, their facepalm moments. Homeless Link is the national membership charity for organisations working directly with people who become homeless in England. We work to make services better and campaign for policy change that will help end homelessness. Homeless Link members get access to benefits that support you to build and develop your organisation and ensure your voice and experience is heard at a national, regional and local level. To find out more about Homeless Link membership for your organisation, visit homeless.org.uk/join. So, another episode of This Much We Know. We are joined today by Levi and Max from Redemption Roasters. Can I get you both to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Levi Fernandez, Head of Impact at Redemption Roasters, looking after all things our impact model.
And I'm Max Tabiel. I'm one of the co-founders of Redemption Roasters.
Brilliant. It was great to have you with us. We're also joined by Simon, my co-host. So, first question to both of you, maybe Max to start with. You've set up sort of a number of different things historically, based on coffee, co-founder of Black Sheep Coffee as well. Social impact moving into that model, has that been part of the big plan? How did that happen?
It wasn't. So I initially worked in the city in consulting, strategy consulting. And then after a couple of years, I think about 3 years, I decided it'd be really nice to do something entrepreneurial around a product that I love and ideally work with people who are my friends rather than sort of just randomly put together in a big corporate. And I got together with three university friends from St. Andrews and we founded Black Sheep Coffee. We had no idea what we were doing. None of us had a coffee background, but we were all determined to be the next big thing in coffee. And we ran into so many different directions. And I was always in charge of wholesale, which didn't really fit into the hospitality aspect and expanding the hospitality aspect. So quite quickly, after about 2 years, I spun that out into a new company because it was clear that we couldn't run it all under one brand. And then had a new company that was essentially distributing Black Sheep Coffee wholesale, which was really interesting, and it was a nice little trading arm, but it was also not that exciting, essentially selling someone else's brand. And so my business partner, my new business partner, and I, also a friend from St. Andrews, former lawyer, decided that we wanted to set up another brand. And we came across somebody in the from the Ministry of Justice at a trade show, and they said, oh, we are looking for a barista training in prisons. Are you interested? And we thought, oh, this sounds interesting. Never been to prison before. And then basically came up with a concept called Redemption Roasters that would tell the story of reducing reoffending and teach on the inside, employ on the outside, and address the big problem that is reoffending in the UK. Up until that point, we had no clue about the whole world and how wrong and how broken the criminal justice system in the UK is.
Yeah, it's a worrying system. Simon does a lot of work in prisons.
I've got some questions. We'll come to that.
Levi, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. So I originally, back in Australia, as I'm sure you can tell from my subtle accent, started an organization called For Change Co. Similar model to Redemption Roasters. Cafes, food truck, coffee cart. We operate under a charity model working with young people at risk of homelessness. So 100% of the profits we generate from our social enterprise venues, we invest into our impact model and provide employment and training in all the businesses that we run. Similar sort of story to Max. We were at university when we started it. We were very fresh, very green, and we were just having a bit of fun. And it snowballed into this little big operation back home in Australia. But the time came for me to sort of move on into a different country. So moved over to the UK and really enjoyed learning about Redemption Roasters. And as luck would have it, they were hiring at the time. So I've been lucky enough to jump on board as the head of impact.
Great. It sounds like a great fit as well.
Yeah, it's worked out really well.
You've been there 9 months.
Yeah, about 8 or 9 months now. And it's been lovely.
Awesome. Great. It's great to hear both of your stories. I think it's so funny. Whenever we have people on the show and talk about sort of their journeys into social impact businesses and things, it's never a kind of, I was going to do that and I was always going to do that. It's always kind of these little conversations you have that turn and snowball into something bigger. And do great things.
Absolutely. I think like mine was the exact opposite, which was a lack of a really clear path post-university, never really feeling like my skill set was really clear on law or medicine or engineering. And I think like finding the value you can create under a social enterprise model was super rewarding and quite interesting too.
I think we're all going to agree on that, aren't we? Max, you've really touched on the prisons briefly and how that sort of came about. What did you expect that to be like, and how has it sort of played out in reality?
I was very naive about the prison system. I'd never been inside, barely know anyone who knows anyone who was in prison. And that's a very privileged bubble one lives in. And I think large majority of us live in this bubble. And what we don't realize is that how the justice system works has a big impact on absolutely everyone. And you can go at that from a really unemotional financial angle. You can just say, well, a lot of my tax money is being spent on this huge monster that's the criminal justice system. But you can go at it from a much more emotional angle and say, the way that a society treats its weakest members is a way of telling how morally sound it is. And if a justice system is really broken, it means that people are just going to go in and out of it, in and out of it. And in the course of that, touch the lives of many, many more people who are related to them, their families, but then also the victims that are created, the communities that are suddenly less safe, and the damage, the financial damage, but also the emotional damage or the trauma that's created through a bad criminal justice system. And unfortunately, the UK is guilty of having really, really bad figures. In terms of what it costs, in terms of the rate of reoffending, in terms of the state of our prisons, in terms of the people working in these prisons. And it's not fair. It's not fair on the people working in these prisons, on offenders, on ex-offenders, and on all of us as a society.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Like Murphy said, I teach business and enterprise in prisons. And again, I was inquisitive, having not had that much contact with the prison sort of system or community. Previously, it's been really interesting to work at that level, just delivering sort of basic learning and training for people, and to see, some of the challenges around the system. It is really difficult, and you probably know this better than I. But I find occasional frustration in that, because I'm like, if only they could see that if we delivered this course properly, it would reduce reoffending. And then you come up against challenges of like the prison system trying to find a room to teach in for the day, and just sort of the basics. And it's really, that insight has been really interesting from my perspective as a sort of community educator or somebody that feels like somebody that helps people learn.
Absolutely. And prison reform doesn't win elections, unfortunately, which is one of the biggest problems that any visionary politician is up against who wants to transform. But it's very, very unsexy to transform, and very expensive. And therefore, people just keep it in the status quo.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with that.
Yeah, I think the political challenges can't be understated, because any political party who talks about being tough on crime, really the only way to be tough on crime is to eliminate poverty. But that is so easy to attack from the opposition, because you're going to be seen as actually being weak on crime because you're investing more and more money into different innovative ideas. But in reality, that would probably be the most effective way to reduce crime, is just eradicate poverty in the UK. Quite a large task, but ultimately is the thing that's going to reduce offending the most.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think, if you were to invest some of that money into those communities where a lot of the prison community come from, we could probably spend our money much better. I find that really difficult, because I'm a sort of youth worker by trade or profession, and then haven't done youth work for a few years now, and then going into prisons and seeing it, you're like, oh, now I'm dealing with adults who are sort of like young people in the same way, like in terms of like, they need training and education and support to thrive. And there's a bit of that at play as well.
Because you want to be led by the numbers, right? And by the logical decisions you should make. But people aren't always rational. They're not always logical. So to be able to communicate, this is research-informed approach, doesn't always marry up with what people actually want to see when someone offends. It doesn't make people feel great when I'm suggesting, let's invest more money into providing employment for someone who's offended, when their gut feeling is, I want to see them punished. When in reality, that's super short-sighted, and we can be doing so much more to support the person in the long term. But that's the big challenge, is being able to communicate logic, data in an emotive way that helps people feel connected and not sort of misinformed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as someone that's just a naive member of the general public, I used to think that the criminal justice system just works. Somebody commits a crime and they get locked up and then they are rehabilitated whilst they're locked up and eventually they'll come out as a changed human being. But it doesn't work like that. It's much, much more complicated. And there's so many factors involved in this. And then about 80% of our prison population gets released every year. But then, depending on what stat you look at, between 50 and 65% re-offend. So it's just a constant revolving door that is just creating victims and bloody expensive. And we're talking about $18.5 billion a year. And that's what re-offending costs the taxpayer.
And what's that definition that gets thrown around all the time? The definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result? We're pumping people through this system, expecting different things to happen. And then when the same thing happens over and over again, we go, let's just build some more prisons. That'll solve it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or let's give out longer sentences. Right. Because it works so well the first time on a short-term basis.
So, yeah, it's difficult. I think one of the things that I really liked about the way that you guys are working with it is that often you see in-prison support offers or post-prison support offers. I really like the fact that you're sort of training on someone's serving their time, and then afterwards it links on. Can you talk a bit more about that and how that idea came about? Was that always the way it was?
Sure. Maybe I can talk about how it came about, and then I think Levi is much better talking about how we currently do it. We originally set it up as just a prison rostry. We were asked to do just barista training in a prison, and we thought it's probably 100 rostry. There's probably 100 companies out there that can do just as well, probably better job than we can. But if we set it up as something a bit more bricks and mortar, higher investment, higher input from all perspectives, then we can really create a brand and a story around the type of impact that we produce. And therefore, we set up our first rostry in HMYOI Aylesbury, which is a Young Offenders Institute. And there had our first guys going through a roasting accreditation, but also just generally getting to know coffee and had some great outcomes, some great little outcomes, because we roughly at the same time opened our first coffee shop on Lambs Conduit Street and hired some of the guys who'd gone through our program straight into that.
Yeah, I think when you're establishing an impact model or you're updating and evolving an impact model, it's really important to reference a few different points of contact. So that would be people already working in the space, speaking to them and saying, what are some of the gaps in the current service model that we could fit? We don't want to try and replicate services that are already out there. We don't want to try to reinvent the wheel. So where are those gaps in the services that are available that we can sort of fit into? And then most importantly, you want to speak to the participants or the recipients of the service you're providing. So we want to speak to guys serving the sentence or people who have offended and are living in the community and asking them, what is it that we can provide or that we could have provided you in the past that would have benefited you the most? And we use that to inform the evolution of our impact model, but primarily when we first started as well, using that process to make sure that we're actually starting on the right foot. And then also just looking to research and the data that's available to us to go, okay, what are the things that people who either are at risk of offending or who have offended need in order to not offend again or not offend in the first place? And we can break that down to sort of six categories. So housing, education, employment, community, confidence, and well-being. And those six pillars, we call them, if a person has access to those six pillars, they're much less likely to offend, and they're actually going to lead really great lives. They're going to be independent, they're going to be in secure employment, safe housing, and surrounded by a community of people that really care about them. And so that's what we use to underpin our approach to our work and make sure that all of our participants have access to those six pillars.
Amazing. And in terms of the sort of longevity of that, obviously the people that you work with, what's the kind of time frames that people engage with you? Do you have much sort of data or insight in what happens after they've sort of moved on from working with you?
So the short answer is it varies. There are some people we work with in prison who would do our course for 3 weeks, not be interested in working with us when they finish their sentence, as that would be the only point of contact we have with them. And then there are guys that come out, do the extra training with us in the community and transition to employment in one of our cafes. There is no hard finish to their time in the program with us. That's the sort of beauty, I think, of our approach, is that we can be really flexible to meet the needs of each individual, and also quite helpful at the scale we're at, that we can still have that individualized approach with all of our participants. So I'd say on average, it's about a 6 to 12 month sort of contact time we have with them. Ideally, we would like for them to continue working with us. But I think the ultimate goal is actually them transitioning into employment in any industry that they're really passionate about. And that's what we identified as our role is, sure, we're going to teach you as much as you'd like to learn about coffee. We're going to provide employment in our cafes. But if you're more interested in law or tourism or tech, our role is actually to equip you with those skills to be able to transition into employment in that field. And that's the, the ultimate goal for us, is when people end up in employment that fulfills them and provides them with a secure income.
Yeah.
And that it was a bit of a learning curve for us when we did it for the first time. I still remember one of our first beneficiaries and graduates coming to me after about 2 months of working in our coffee shop on Namskondit Street and just saying, I'm really sorry, I found a well-paid job as a lorry driver and I'm going to leave you guys next month. And I just thought, oh God, what have we done wrong? Like, our whole impact model is just, it's not working. And then I realized, actually, we've done our job, right? I mean, he's not reoffending. He's found a well-paid job. It's not going to be in coffee, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's about that bridge. I see social enterprise having a unique place as a bridge to mainstream employment, in that we can do all that, the support and those jobs. But ultimately, we want people to move on, and almost like reverse business, in that we want to get rid of our good people and develop those that are struggling still and keep them coming through, which is, from a business perspective, quite a difficult concept, because in the commercial sort of business sector, you do the opposite. You get rid of the people that are slowing you down or need that development because they cost time and money. On the flip side, we had Alistair Jackson on, who works up north, and they recycle televisions in prisons. And he's got some classic stories of, like, where he's had lorries rip gates off the prison and that sort of stuff, which he'll tell us off for constantly talking about. But here's a good story, to be fair. Have you got any sort of, yeah, classic stories like that where you think, ah, yeah, we should have thought about that a bit better? Or
we call them our facepalm moments, where you're like, what have I done?
I do remember that when we, for the first time, started packaging not just coffee, but also our teas, which we still need to come in bulk packaging in the prison. And we had big shrink-wrapped parcels of dried green leaves go into the prison. Certainly caused some raised eyebrows with security, let's just say.
That's brilliant.
It's tea, honestly.
We've heard that before.
Where are you at in the sort of journey of Redemption Roasters? So founded, remind me when you were founded, what year? So
we were founded in 2015/16, end of 15. Yeah.
Okay. And then so seven years in. What's the sort of long-term goal for Redemption?
To continue growing and also locking in our impact into our growth. Ever since we started, our impact has been an essential part of what we do. It's not been the only part of what we do. We're not a charity. It's important that we make money in order to grow, which is why we're a social impact or profit for purpose organization, as they call them. And as such, we will never treat our impact as just a gimmick, but also we will never treat it as just the thing that we do. We need to think as a business to create that kind of impact. And I think in the legal profession, they have a term that's called lockstep. So you sort of lock in your impact. And you can do that in various ways. And one quite simple measure is just look at the percentage of beneficiaries that you employ, right? I mean, that's one simple thing. If somebody asks me, oh, is this just a marketing gimmick? I say, actually, no, we employ somewhere between 20 and 25% of our staff from our beneficiary workforce. And that means something. And there are loads of other ways that you can set it up. And Levo will know a lot more about this than me.
Is that the goal, sort of a quarter of the workforce?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We are sort of looking realistically at it. We know there are limits of what we can do. And also we know that it fluctuates greatly, depending on how our community pipeline looks, how our in-custody pipeline looks. And we're also quite realistic. I mean, looking at really well-intentioned businesses such as Timpson's, they have about a 10-12% split. So I think as we grow, it may be that our percentages drop. But then again, the total impact is huge that Timpson's creates.
And also, the percentage doesn't always reflect the quality of the outcomes we're producing. We could have a great 6 months where a lot of the guys who are graduating from our programs are actually transitioning into employment in external partners. And so that will reflect a lower percentage of our total workforce being made up of our beneficiaries. But actually, it's not showing that we've had a really strong 6 months. And so it's finding that balance between what we're trying to help the public understand about what we're doing, but also measuring and evaluating our work in a really clear way.
Yeah, it's good. Coming back to the James Timpson, or Timpson's comment, I listened to a podcast with him on recently, and he's quite interesting because he's like, yeah, it's actually only 9-10% of our workforce have previously been in prison. And he's like, but it's quite good that the public think it's almost 100% because it brings people to us. Where do you sit on that as a sort of, a USP of Redemption Coffee Roasters? Is that an integral key message that you want to put out, or are you quietly doing the impact, as a byproduct of being a successful business?
No, the impact is costing us a hell of a lot, just speaking from like a P&L perspective, and therefore we needed to do its bit. And we are using it. We are milking the fact that we are a social impact organization, and shamelessly doing that, right? We want our investors to know, we want our landlords to know, we want our customers to know. I think back in the day, we were guilty of not doing that well enough. And we did a sort of haphazard survey, and a very small proportion of our day-to-day customers knew that we were employing ex-offenders. And so now we try and plaster it all over the walls. We make sure that our baristas know a couple of things to say if somebody asks them about it. It's very well present on our social media and our website, and it helps us. And I always like to say that you can do really well by doing good, and that's what I like to preach to other social entrepreneurs: is use your social impact, use it for your advantage.
Yeah, and our mission is embedded in every decision that we make at the organization. Our mission is to reduce reoffending through specialty coffee. And so whilst we scream and shout about it so everyone knows about it, internally we want everyone to be really on the same page when it comes to when you're working at Redemption Roasters. We're here to reduce reoffending. And so I think it helps when we are measuring and evaluating our work and then being able to communicate that with the public, but equally internally, so everyone feels like we're on the same page.
Yeah, no, I can see that. In your sort of experience in before sort of working in the city, working in law firms, having that sort of different side of working in the social sector, and then your background being more in the social sector, where do you see social enterprises in terms of the wider society? Do you think it's kind of this middle ground between charity and business? Where would you place it? What do you think the future of social enterprise is?
I think it's still really early days for social enterprises and for social enterprises to grow large in the original manner that they set out to have. And I think in terms of the measurement and the evaluation, we are yet to have a really good framework or an accrediting organization that can help investors and other stakeholders judge a company by its social impact, because all too often there may be a veneer of something that looks like social impact, and it doesn't actually have it behind it. I mean, greenwashing and
branding,
all of these terms. So,
because I think one of the challenges is, back in Australia, one of our cafes where 100% of the profits are invested into tackling youth homelessness, we provide employment and training for young people at risk of homelessness in the cafe, was about 400 meters away from another social enterprise cafe that every month gave away $500 to a charitable cause. So it's a stark contrast between what some social enterprises are and what others are too. And so I think it'd be really helpful if we can have a bit clearer of a definition of what one is, so that we're not all just grouped together, because there are some very significant differences between social enterprises out there.
Yeah, there's really different models, isn't there? But yeah.
I mean, it's still not a legal term. We talk about social enterprise as if it's a defining characteristic, and it's just not it's kind of a term that we household name that isn't really understood. I think there's a lot of confusion around how that ties in with legal structures, which actually segues me on lovely to my next question, kind of where you guys are at the moment. I know you talked about thinking about what different legal structures mean in terms of working as a charity. Where are you now, and what are your thoughts on where you need to go for that, for funding?
In the very early days when we set this company up, I managed to get 20 minutes in James Timpson's diary, and he spoke to me and gave me some really good advice. And one of the things he said was, from a really early point onwards, try and set up your profit and loss in a way that you can see how much you're investing in the social impact activities and how much that's costing you, and potentially even how much benefit it creates. But that's really, as in, creates for the company and also for the wider public, but that's next level. That's really difficult to calculate. And so that idea of reverberated, and we've always tried to have a really strong finance team who can show us what our profitable activities are and what part of our profitable activities are reinvested into the purpose. And we have last year decided that we want to launch a charity, a Redemption Rosters Foundation, and we've named it, bit of a working title, not very creative. And obviously charity stands on its own, right? It's not, charity can't be owned by a profit-making entity. It can work the other way around, it's something I learned. And as part of that, it will be much more transparent what we as a company do for the social impact and how that's set up. So we publicize our accounts, but at the moment it's all under one entity. And then there'll be two entities, and there'll be money going from one entity to the other. And that's the social impact activities that we create.
And in terms of the funding that's linked into it, we see a lot of questions on the program that we run. There's always questions from sort of our social entrepreneurs and charities saying, you know, what structure is going to give me opportunities for funding? We see new grants coming out with, you know, if you're a kit, only charities, whatever, but it can cause difficulties. Has that been a big influence in this? How does that fit into the work that you'll be leading on?
So I suppose launching the charitable arm or the charitable organization, the main objective behind that is to secure more funding so we can increase the capacity of the organization to deliver more services to more people. Relying solely on revenue generated from our commercial Redemption Roasters cafes limits the number of people we can welcome into our program. And as I'm sure you guys are aware, there are no shortage of people that are looking to enroll in our program. So we're trying to equip ourselves with everything we can to make sure that we're ready to meet their needs. Being able to work with philanthropic, corporate, and government funders as a charity has many perks. For Change Code, the social enterprise that I started back in Australia, we operate under a charity model. So we've never actually taken any investment, and we've always worked to secure philanthropic funding to launch social enterprise cafes and to support our work. In this instance, we're going to obviously be running the commercial entities side by side with the charity. But my job within the charity is to go out and find people that want to join our community and support our work and see where their money goes. That's the sort of underlying logic behind the charitable launch.
Great, thank you.
And just going back historically, when we started this, we needed money to set up our first roastery and then also to open coffee shops. Opening coffee shops is really expensive. And we got investment on board. I mean, the three Fs, the friends, the families, and the fools. And the first few rounds, we did three rounds. And I guess at the beginning, there's more friends, family, and fools. And then as you grow, hopefully there's less. And I'd say about 30% of our investors are socially driven. So they like the fact that there will hopefully be a payout at the end of it and they'll make a return on their investment. But ultimately, we have a purpose, and it's not just another fintech company, but it has a real purpose. And as we grew, I think that the type of funding that we've been taking on has just become a little bit more professional, but still split has remained. And one thing that also happened before we even came up with the idea of a charity is we were approached by philanthropic funders who said, "Oh, we love what you guys do. We don't want to invest in the main company. We know you're not fundraising right now, but can we just give you some money?" And we thought, "Oh, this is a bit weird. We can't really just take money. It doesn't work like that for profit-making companies." And then we started setting up specific projects that people could put money into, and we would run a completely open book what we're doing with this, and obviously we would match fund in terms of our own time in administering these projects. And that has worked quite well, but that only goes up to a point. And then you want to demonstrate a charity. And then also, I mean, for tax reasons, right? We looked into setting up a KIC, but some of our funders just said, actually, it's not that tax advantageous. I might as well just give the company the money to a limited company.
And not everyone is so trustworthy, right? To be able to donate funds to a profit-making company, they want to be able to donate to a charity who have the responsibilities to report on their finances clearly. And so I think even though we're really lucky to have some donors that were willing to work with us in the current sort of structure that we operate, running the charity is going to allow more and more people to trust what we're doing and come into the community.
Mm. Yeah, it's quite a rarity to find funders, grant makers in particular, with that sort of switched on and like, okay, we could do this. This is just how we're going to do it. But most of them would go, oh, you're not a charity. All right, let's not. Yeah, this isn't going to happen. So there's quite, yeah. It sounds like you've found a niche funder there who's willing to be flexible on that and stuff. I think it's fascinating that you've split in the company. We're not splitting, but you're setting up the foundation. I think it's a really interesting way to approach it. What would you advise? And I really like your, Levi, when you're talking about the sort of six pillars, I love that. And that just structured approach to doing enterprise is quite rare that people are that sort of, let's have a look at this before we get involved and let's actually think about how we're going to model this and do it. What advice would you both give? And Levi, you've set up other social enterprises as well. What advice would you give to others looking to set up social enterprise?
I mean, primarily make sure you're not replicating a service that's already being provided, that's already quite good. We don't need a million people doing the same thing. I think that's what we've tried to do here is we've found a niche and we really try and stay on task. I'm not particularly good at doing that. Max is very good at keeping me task oriented, but I can get a tendency to get very excited by new projects and try and expand and all this sort of stuff. But ultimately, when we do just stay true to mission and keep going back to what our vision is, it helps us make sure that we are providing a service that people really need and we're not just diluting the playing field. So I think the big tip would just make sure you're not replicating a service. But two, I think just make sure that every decision you're making is being informed by either people with lived experience of the sort of issue that you're tackling, people that have worked in the area, or just the data that's available to you. You know, it's really good to use your heart to guide some of the decisions when you're working in the social enterprise space. But a lot of the decisions that we're making, you really need to make sure that logic and data is informing your approach, because otherwise you're just shooting in the dark. You might have great intentions, but ultimately you're not actually holding yourself accountable for the outcomes that you're creating for your participants. And I think that's something that I'm trying to really, you know, strike home for my team, is that we have a huge capacity to cause harm in the work that we're doing, because we're working with particularly vulnerable people, either in prison or recently released. And so we need to hold ourselves accountable to make sure that every interaction we're having with them is as positive as it can be, and we're acknowledging that there is a huge risk of harm there. So what can we do to mitigate that risk, and what can we do to maximize the benefit that they can receive from the program? And it's not a particularly fun process doing that. It's quite arduous. It's a little bit boring. But I think it's something that everyone needs to be able to realize, is that when you're working with vulnerable groups, there is always potential for harm. And if you're not acknowledging that, you're just burying your head in the sand.
Yeah. No, I think you spoke very eloquently there. And I think the thoughtful approach of acknowledging the power dynamics as well involved in those kind of relationships. We've recently launched some research around, it's called A Fair Deal. It's around looking at these mitigating risks of exploitation within social enterprise models, particularly looking at areas of like indebtedness and, you know, people wanting to give back and take unfair wage opportunities to still be part of something that need for community. So yeah, hearing your thoughtful approach of how you're working people is really great to hear. In terms of bringing in that lived experience to decision-making processes, you know, it's something that the sector, both charitable and social enterprise, struggle with a huge amount. You often get one voice who's really keen to be involved, but perhaps not representative of the group that you're working with. How do you guys tackle that?
You just got to cough up and pay. Like, it's really the only way to do it. You need to pay people a fair wage, bring people with our lived experience and embed them into the decision-making process that relates to the program. We have an incredible intern that's working with us at the moment who brings a really unique perspective to the work we do. And, you know, seeing him work with our participants just re-emphasized to me the value of having people with lived experience in your program. And if you can't afford it, one of the sort of cheaper ways of doing it is to create an advisory board of people with lived experience, so that you can bring them into the decision-making process. You don't have to provide full-time employment. You obviously still pay them for their time, but it's much fewer hours than a full-time employee. And that way you get a diverse range of experiences because it's a board of people. They get great experience of like learning more about sort of corporate charitable structures and how their voice really does have meaning. But I think that's something I've seen used really well, is either bringing people on in full-time or part-time employment into the business or the organization,
but also that advisory board filled with people with lived experience.
Oh, thank you. That was really helpful. I'm sure our listeners would be keen to know your ideas on that.
Some great answers, actually. It's been really good chatting with you both. Hopefully it will be inspiring for people to listen and figure out. I think you're really quite different in your approach that you've taken and how you've developed some of our other guests. So it's been really nice to have you on and have a bit of diversity and sort of approaches to this, because it is, social enterprise is difficult, isn't it? And I think that's one of the key things we wanted to capture in this podcast, is helping people to go, it is going to be quite hard, and what are the things to sort of avoid, to stop us replicating those mistakes. Let's replicate the impact and the good stuff, but not the bits that didn't go so well. And I guess final question to you both is, what would you advise to people setting out doing social enterprise? What advice would you give to them?
To be naive and not too naive. I think had we known all the lessons that we will be learning or that we would be learning, we would have probably not done it, or we would have done it vastly differently, but we would be a completely different business today. Things like setting up your minimal viable product, which was for us setting up a small roastery in one particularly difficult prison, and then realizing quite quickly, yes, this works, but it doesn't work in this space, and we have to move all of this thing and move it into another space, created a huge amount of work and costs, and we had to do another fundraise, but had we been able to secure a much larger space to start with, who knows whether we would have secured the funding for it, right? So, and just generally, I mean, working with a big ministry, I mean, we're working with the Ministry of Justice. I'm sure a lot of social enterprises are working with other ministries or public bodies. Their incentive structure is just completely different to what yours is, and their speed of decision making is completely different to yours as well. So, just taking that into account, I think, is really important.
I think just finding a community of people to kind of take with you on your journey. It's an incredibly challenging process starting and operating a social enterprise, but having friends, family, colleagues that you can really rely on and feel like they're in your corner fighting for you, I think makes the journey a whole lot easier. And also acknowledging that the balance between profit and impact is incredibly difficult to achieve. I still don't think there's an objectively correct way to operate a social enterprise in terms of how far do you weigh profit versus impact. There's a million ways to go about it. And I think acknowledge that I haven't ever felt like I've gotten it perfectly right. I hope one day it feels like that. But just acknowledge that, you might not get there in the first few years.
Thank you, Beth. That was really, one of the things that we're trying to use this platform to do is to remind people that everyone's on a journey. No one thinks that they're doing it fabulously, and it is difficult, and talking is really important. Your honesty is really appreciated there, and I'm sure will be by our listeners as well. If you had a wand, magic wand, and there was sort of one wish that you could make sort of on behalf of Redemption Roosters, what would the big ask be?
I'd really love to see the criminal justice system totally changed, and always informed by best practice data and people with lived experience. And if what's needed for that to happen is a political party is given like a state of what would you call it, like the public just don't get upset about it, like let's just do that, because it's just such a massive problem that's going to take a long time to solve. But I'd love to see the criminal justice system reformed in its totality.
Is some of the work that you're doing around sort of policy and advocacy within that space, or is that sort of potentially a future?
Yeah, we try our best to be thought leaders in the space. And yes, I think my wish would be quite along the lines of that, sort of just to make ourselves not necessary anymore. It'd be great if we could just become another coffee company because our principal purpose is no longer necessary.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us today and for hosting us as well. It's been great. Where can people find you if they want to look up Twitter, LinkedIn?
Website, Instagram, we are quite active. And then obviously we've got 11 beautiful shops around London. And if you want to look for the locations, just Google us or look it up on the website.
And if you're wondering what the best way to support us is, visit our cafes. But if there's a particular skill set or resource that you're looking to provide the Redemption Roasters team, please get in contact with us, because we're always looking for people to join our community and sort of join our mission to tackle reoffending in the UK.
Absolutely. And we'll be fundraising quite soon, both probably crowdfunding as well as more professional fundraising. And so, yeah, we'll keep you posted.
Great.
Brilliant. Thank you both.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe for more episodes or follow us on Twitter at thismuch_weknow or email us at thismuchweknow@homelesslink.org.uk.